C'est pas tranquille.
It's not an easy road, and it's not a comfortable one. It can't be.
When I met academic Réjeanne Sénac, she told me that for her, doubt is deeply rooted with feminism.
To take this road means to grieve. It's a loss of any sense of comfort.
In second grade, I learned that in French grammar, the masculine prevails over the feminine. So I applied the rule. In seventh grade, I start wearing bras. I don't want to, but I'm told I don't have a choice. In 11th grade, I'm passionate about math, but they push me to study literature instead. I pick math anyway. I move along in the world with the certainties I've been taught. There are social boxes to fit into, unchangeable truths to accept. At 17, I open Simone de Beauvoir's book, Memories of a Dutiful Daughter, after picking it up at the neighborhood library.
Être femme, ce n'est pas une donnée naturelle.
Within its pages, I discover feminism for the first time. And then boom, it's a one-way ticket to another world, a new world. The boxes break. The truth changes. At 20, I learned that women have not always been the only ones to wear dresses and heels. At the court of King Louis XIV, up until the 18th century, it was a common way of dressing for men. I learned that from the Middle Ages to the 20th century, the color blue was associated with the Virgin Marie, a symbol of divine purity and femininity, and that in reality, the affirmation of pink for girls and blue for boys is a 20th century gender marketing innovation. Another desire shaped by our capitalist society like cigarettes for women, which we discussed in the previous episodes. The purpose of Pink for Girls? To encourage parents to dress their children according to their gender, and therefore to buy more clothes. A bit later, I learned that the masculine has not always taken precedence over the feminine. This French grammar rule only dates back to the 17th century. And so, from then I began to ask myself, how many of the things I take as a given are going to be called into question? I couldn't help but begin to doubt everything I'd ever known. I started to worry. And from that constant doubting, another question was born. Will the doubt ever go away? Will it stop?
When English was a new language, writers could invent new words and
or will it get the better of me?
Nowadays, it's easy enough to invent new words. They spring to the lips whenever we see a new sight or feel a new sensation.
I think of those feminists who lost their minds. Virginia Woolf, who suffered from depression, wrote in her farewell letter that she was committing suicide because she did not want to go mad. Shulamith Firestone, a Canadian and American feminist with schizophrenia, was found dead in her home after she stopped eating. I know that Virginia Woolf and Shulamith Firestone suffered from mental illnesses. But I can't help but wonder, was it feminism and the doubts that come with it that delivered their coup de grace? To be a feminist is to doubt all the time. And to doubt everything is also to question oneself, especially one's desires, as we saw in the last episode. A radical way of thinking leads to a permanent questioning of one's innermost certainties, values and principles, and even self-esteem. And it's exhausting.
I've lived through it. It's hard. And at one point, I went through a phase of thinking, you've fought a lot in your life, in all areas. You've had to make some radical choices. All that to find yourself alone with your cat, to sum it up.
There are some very nice cats, though.
He's great. He's called Dream, which is ironic.
So, is it okay to constantly doubt our choices, our ideas? Is there a balance to be found between doubting the system, criticizing it, and doubting ourselves? In this episode, we will look at the extent to which doubt is necessary for creating a feminist society, and that a balance can be actually achieved. My name is Rebecca Amselem. I'm a French and Canadian feminist activist. Welcome to The Method.
I'm always debating with myself in my daily practice, and then with other people too, because there are lots of questions that don't have answers.
Yuri Casalino is a feminist activist, aerospace engineer, documentary filmmaker, and spin doctor. The most recent politician she worked with was Sandrine Rousseau, a former candidate for the French presidential election in 2022. Yuri Casalino agrees with Réjeanne Sénac that the life of an activist is based on the principle of doubt.
But intellectually, I find that it's better to have doubts and troubles. We're more alive when we have them. We think more. I think the brain is more stimulated when there are uncertainties, when we're constantly questioning things. I think it's much more interesting to operate with trouble. In fact, Donna Haraway's latest book is called Staying with the Trouble.
Donna Haraway is an American feminist scientist. She is one of the pioneers of cyberfeminism. Cyberfeminism is what we call the range of feminist activities that are based on digital technologies. Donna Haraway is also the founder of the concept of situated knowledge. This concept encourages us to specify where we're speaking from, to specify one's gender or economic situation, for example, before expressing oneself on a subject. It is a more honest approach, she says, because no one piece of information can be 100% objective.
So it's about remaining in that trouble and living with that doubt, not knowing what to do with it and keeping it as a source of energy.
For Yuri Casalino, the concept of trouble is essential to the feminist movement. I completely agree. Rather than struggling against the trouble of doubt, I like the idea that you have to embrace it to move forward.
I think I've sort of gotten to the point where I'm letting go of a lot of my doubts. Not the trouble, but more like not being sure of myself or my worth, of what I can accomplish and how I can make a difference in the world.
I'm starting to understand that there are two types of doubt. The one that scares you, that emerges when your foundations and certainties are shaken. This kind of doubt leads to a loss of self-esteem, to the fear of not being up to the task, to a state of paralysis. Self-paralysis at first, but also a paralysis of our struggle for a feminist society. And then there's another kind of doubt, the doubt that helps us to question the relevance of our institutions. It is this doubt that allows us to develop a critique of the current world. It is this doubt that is inherent to feminism.
To me, doubt is a strategy, because it's a way of getting out of a behavior of automatism, or of the idea of what should be done, or how a situation should be solved, or how something that's happening should be reoriented, as if there were a set of obvious solutions.
This is Veronica Gago, the Argentinian sociologist and activist who we heard from when we talked about joy. She explains how doubt is central to her methodology as a feminist activist. If you listen to the episode about joy, you already know this. Veronica Gago is a co-founder of the New Naminos movement, which means not one woman less. It's a feminist movement of phenomenal scope that has given rise to massive demonstrations in Argentina, Chile, Peru, but also in Spain, to fight against violence against women, and in particular femicide. It's one of the biggest feminist movements of the 21st century. It even has its own anthem, El Violador es tú, meaning the rapist is you in Spanish.
So I would say that doubt is not the opposite of action, that it's not a form of paralysis, and that the question is to know how, on the contrary, we can make doubt a moment of collective self-reflection.
To doubt is to give ourselves spaces to reflect, to allow ourselves the opportunity to question the obvious in order to invent new possibilities.
I think that doubt is part of the process of political production. It's about creating a space to ask ourselves why what is happening, and how we're going to interpret it, and how we're going to direct our energy in order to transform it. If there were no doubts, there would be no questioning. Everything would be perfectly clear. Sometimes doubt also means giving yourself time to do nothing at all.
Doubt offers us the opportunity to put ourselves at intellectual risk, to be able to escape preconceived frameworks and conditioning and allow for criticism. It doesn't necessarily represent a questioning of oneself. On the contrary, it opens up the possibility of changing the world. Doubt also allows us to question our practices as activists, as women, as human beings. When she was little, my mom's grandfather, an artist, would often ask her what color the clouds were. White, she would answer. White? Are you sure? Of course the clouds are white. They look white, they seem white, we're taught that they're white. But one day she understood. At first sight, clouds are white. But actually, they're anything but. They're blue, they're green, they're gray, they're yellow, they're red. And that was the day she realized that she was an artist. And it's the same thing with feminism. We're taught that it's normal to live in a society where the masculine is treated as the universal default. But the day you realize it's not, it is the day you become a feminist. In the previous episode, Christian Gotzi explained this using a toothbrush metaphor.
I use the example of brushing your teeth and how, for those of us, you know, who brush our teeth every day, twice a day, it becomes such an ordinary activity that if you suddenly decide, for whatever reason, to use your other hand and brush your teeth with the opposite hand than you normally do, it feels so weird to do that. And it sort of jars you out of the natural feeling of this thing.
Being a feminist means breaking free from automatic behavior. It means no longer accepting the narrative we've been sold, which can be reinvented.
Yeah, I think it should be part of how we work, and that's the only precious resource we have as feminists, these doubts.
Yuri Casalino tells us to cultivate doubt, to ask ourselves, for example, about the relevance of the current debate in France on the wearing of the Islamic veil in various public places.
What do I know about whether the hijab is sexist or not? I ask myself that question every day. I have friends who wear the hijab, and I also have friends who tell me the hijab is death because they live in countries where it's mandatory. So I don't know the answer. This doubt will always remain with us. So the great strength of feminism is the trouble, is the doubt.
Faut-il interdire le port du voile en France dans l'espace public?
Quand il y a des femmes voilées, on n'est plus en France.
La France a-t-elle un problème avec le voile?
La question du port du voile en sortie scolaire.
Ce à quoi nous devons nous attaquer.
We must confront Islamist separatism, which manifests itself in repeated divergence from the values of the Republic.
The veil is a typical example of how people publicly express opinions on issues without asking the right questions. For example, what is the view of the women who actually wear the veil? Do they think it's sexist? Do they all wear it for the same reasons? How do their living conditions affect their decision to wear it or not? For Yuri Casalino, these are all the questions that we should be addressing in the media, because it's precisely by asking them that we come to realize that the debate of for and against is just meaningless. And for this, it is necessary to doubt, because if we just accept the polarization of for and against without questioning it, then we're not questioning ourselves. Nuance leads us to the conclusion that there should be no public debate about women's right to choose what they wear, and that feminists must fight against any system that tries to tell them how to dress. And through our questioning, doubt can finally give way to nuanced rather than polarized thinking. Doubt gets us out of vicious cycles. By eliminating what we think we know, doubt brings us to nuance, and this is what advances women's rights. At this point, we know that we can't simply say that there's a good and a bad doubt. We just can't boil things down to good doubt as world-saving doubt and bad doubt as toxic doubt. A particular doubt can be beneficial to us at one point in our lives and jeopardize our self-esteem at another. The trick is to find a balance.
I love talking about nuance.
We are hearing now from Carla Bergman, the Canadian researcher and author of Joyful Militancy.
So I think nuance is based off of the French word, I'm going to butcher it, but noon, which just means cloud. And that is something that I always really try to keep into focus. It's that when we're in nuance, we're a little bit cloudy. And what I mean is that we're uncertain. And so to me, nuance, embracing like a real nuance, is one of the best ways to ward off rigidity, because it is, you know, radicalism, if we're talking about getting back to the roots, like to the earth, to the beauty of a mycelium, you know, horizontally stretching out over the planet. It's complex and it's cloudy and it's nuanced. And so I think it's asking us to show up in ways with curiosity and finding ways and accepting the discomfort of sitting in these questions that are sometimes challenging.
This is the answer to doubt: nuance. Nuance is the healthy answer to doubt, which is essential to critical thinking. Nuance makes the debate more constructive by stripping away its rigidity and polarization. To move towards a feminist society whose values are not clashing but openness and discussion, we need nuance. And now that I've said that, I must also say this. Embracing nuance as a feminist is not very easy. I remember a story.
Réponse d'Emmanuel Macron. À l'école, je suis plutôt tenue décente, exigée. Je ne suis pas défenseur de
l'uniforme. It was on the 14th of September 2020. I was invited by BFM, which is a French news channel, to talk about crop tops at school. That day, girls and boys from all over France went to school in crop tops and miniskirts in support of those who'd been expelled for wearing them. Should we let our girls wear what they want to high school? That was the anchor opening line. The atmosphere was pretty tense, and I was bracing myself for floods of criticism. There I was, facing yet another conservative whose stance on the crop top had very little nuance. To him, it wouldn't have mattered whether we were talking about style in a crop top. It was basically the same thing. At one point, not straight away though, the anchor asked me what I thought of the protest, and I immediately answered, "Of course I support these young girls. Of course they're right to protest for the right to wear what they want. I'm behind them all the way." My position seemed clear. I wanted it to be understood that I supported them. And I do. But as with all the issues, with all the campaigns, my stance on it is a bit more nuanced. I could have said, without putting my support into question, I think it would be interesting to specify that young girls are often sexualized. And yes, this phenomenon does tend to get worse when they wear sexy clothes, like crop tops, for instance. But it's also getting worse because boys are not being taught to respect girls' bodies. The solution is not merely to encourage girls to cover their bodies, but also to teach boys not to sexualize them. But I didn't say any of that. First, because it's impossible to say such a long sentence on this channel without getting cut. And then because as a speaker, you want to go straight to the point. You want to convince people. And to do that, you go to the simplest, more persuasive approach. And we ignore the topic's more specific details so as to be able to promote more important values, such as women's rights. And in this specific case, their right to dress how they want. So after I'd shown my support, instead of giving my more nuanced answer, I just added, "But it's the adults that are at fault. They see the wrong in everything girls do." In a slightly more eloquent way, of course. Because a feminist who shows doubts in public, in the nuanceless world of the mainstream media, is easy prey for conservatives. If we say,
Endometriosis affects 1 in 10 women. Of course, I'm not a doctor. Oh, you admit you have no credibility, they would reply. Because when you express the slightest nuance, the words of the opposite stance to the one you're actually defending or put in your mouth, we're implicitly discouraged from having nuanced opinions. The media sees nuance as a conservative trait and anger as a trait of the feminist struggle. Yet initially, the notion was mostly defended by left-wing intellectuals with humanist values, like the French writer Albert Camus and the Marxist philosopher Simone Weil. Simone Weil was an intellectual who said that the absence of doubt and nuance constantly distances us from the truth. In her book called On the Abolition of All Political Parties, published in France in 1940, Simone Weil wrote, "People have progressively developed the habit of thinking in all domains only in terms of being in favor of or against any opinion. And afterwards, they seek arguments to support one of these two options." This might remind you of Yuri Casalino's reflection on the relevance of clear-cut position concerning the wearing of the veil. Well, Simone Weil made exactly the same point 80 years ago. Writer Albert Camus also fought for nuance. In his letters to a German friend, a fictitious correspondence published in the Combat newspaper during World War II, he explained the importance of nuance. "We are fighting for the nuance between sacrifice and mysticism, between energy and violence, between strength and cruelty. For that even finer nuance between the true and the false, between the men of the future and the cowardly gods you revere. And I am tempted to tell you that it so happens that we are fighting for fine nuances, but the kind of nuances that are as important as man himself. What the two intellectuals meant in their work is that we desperately need nuance. And at the same time, it seems that nuanced statements tend not to be listened to. Expressing oneself in a simple and clear-cut way seems to bring more support, more approval. But for me, real courage is knowing how to have both a radical and nuanced way of thinking. I call this the courage of radical balance. It means accepting that you can't please everyone, but you can choose to be measured in how you communicate. You can choose to be constructive rather than reactive." Nuance is not only useful on a personal basis to help develop our own thinking or to make meaningful contributions to a debate. Nuance is also necessary on a collective basis, within a social movement, for instance. And it is Sarah Schulman who again sheds light on this issue. In addition to having written Conflict is Not Abuse, the researcher was an activist with ACT UP New York, an organization committed to end AIDS. She wrote a book based on her work there called Let the Record Show: A Political History of ACT UP New York, 1987-1993. It draws on the testimonies of former activists of the organization. And according to Sarah Schulman, a homogeneous social movement will always be less effective than a movement in which there is a whole nuance of activist practices, ways of thinking, and types of mobilization.
Yeah, there's an obsession now with homogenized thinking. I don't totally understand what it comes from, but I do know that it is completely ineffective. Like, I just finished this 750-page book about the history of ACT UP New York. That was a very effective political movement. And one of the reasons they were effective is that they did not have to agree. So there was no consensus in the group. If you wanted to do something, we had a bottom line. You have to have a bottom line. What are your values? Historically, movements that have tried to force people into one analysis or one strategy have all failed, and I don't think there are any exceptions. You know, whether it's the most ideological Marxism or a pure kind of feminism or whatever it's been, it doesn't work. Because people can only be where they're at, and you can't make people be somewhere that they're not. So a good movement helps people be effective from where they are. But you can't always be trying to make them be like you. It just doesn't work.
A nuanced movement is better than a homogeneous one. And besides, no movement is truly homogeneous. When there's internal division, it's impossible to convince an activist who doesn't want to be convinced. So for Sarah Schulman, if there are differences in opinion, you might as well embrace them. This is to avoid polarizing the movement, which would divide its activists and weaken the cause.
Our values were direct action to end the AIDS crisis. If you had an idea that was direct action to end the AIDS crisis and I thought it was bad, I just wouldn't do it. But I wouldn't try to stop you from doing it. You would do it, and then I would get 10 people who wanted to do my idea, and we would do that. And what this radical democracy structure produces is a simultaneity of action. So that you have different kinds of actions going on at the same time that have different aesthetics, different approaches.
For the author, nuance allows for what she calls simultaneity of action within social movements. The advantage of having several points of view is that different actions can be developed and carried out simultaneously. In this sense, a nuanced movement also has a greater scope and a greater effectiveness. It is nuance that allowed ACT UP fight against AIDS to be lasting and successful, and we want this for the feminist movement as well.
So, yeah, to me, black feminism is like a foundation of nuance.
Rennie Edel Lodge is a 32-year-old British feminist journalist. She is the first black woman to become a number one bestseller in the UK with her book, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race. It was published in 2017. Here, she explained that it was the difference in nuance that she found between black feminism and white feminism that made her want to fight even more. Because to her, black feminism felt way more relevant than the white feminism she had always known until then.
You know, it brings like a foundation of nuance to, you know, my understanding of inequality in a way that, you know, a certain type of rigid feminism, some might have called it radical 30, 40 years ago. I'm not quite sure what I'd call it now.
Rennie Edel Lodge is referring to white feminism, the feminist movement led by white women in the West and more specifically by the suffragettes in the UK. The author explains why she finds white feminism uninclusive and too rigid. White feminism is severely lacking in nuance.
And I'm not trying to, like, do down the feminists who came up, you know, like, came up with those thoughts because they did, you know, great things for women at the time, you know. But the more I got interested in black feminism, the more I realised, like, it's just too rigid a view, you know. It's just too rigid a lens because not all women are facing, like, yes, all women face, you know, misogyny and sexism and, like, regardless of your, you know, class, culture, creed, like, sexual violence is a particular kind of, like, misogyny that, like, affects us all and we all live under the threat of it. But I'm not in the same, like, class as a white woman, a white British woman who's descended from landed gentry, you know? I'm not, like... and actually, we can see that kind of, like, rigidity of, like, binary... like, a binary view of, like, women and men, and, like, men are always the oppressors of women, like, it actually works to collapse the intersections of, like discrimination, you know?
White feminism is therefore an anti-patriarchal school of thought, but one that is tainted by white supremacy. This is also called whiteness, an attitude that is the complete opposite of nuance.
So I remember, like, writing in the book, like, I wrote this whole chapter on class, and, like, I tried to end it by saying, at least where I'm from, which is basically inner city London, you know, the picture of a working class person is most likely to be a black single mother, you know, living on an estate, like living in poverty, you know. And she's facing not just misogyny and sexism, but she's also facing racism and classism. And all of that informs, you know, how she navigates the world around her. and the barriers that she'll face. And she's not facing the same barriers as a white woman whose dad is a CEO, you know, who's middle to upper class. She's simply not, you know. So, yeah, there are arms of feminism who, like, are very, like, committed to a kind of rigid binary thinking that is simply, you know, it's in conflict with an intersectional approach, right? And this isn't like, oh, this isn't like Oppression Olympics, but it's more, I guess, like, for me, like, black feminism was a way to develop an understanding of how inequality, like, interacts and affects different people in our society, right? You know?
The author realized that there are many shades and branches of feminism. In a nod to our episode on radicality, it's not a conversion of struggles we need, but a willingness to multiply gardens and then share them. Another term to define shared gardens would be the intersectionality of demands.
You know, black feminism helped me understand and brought me to things like, you know, queer feminism. You know, I think it's you know, that just that understanding of intersectionality, you know, and, you know, it helped me understand, like, how homophobia, you know, intersects with sexism, like how class intersects with sexism, you know, like all of these things. To me, it just feels like a very inherently nuanced approach.
I've always said that the more conflicting ideas and ways of thinking there are, the stronger and bigger the feminist movement is. At least I said it in my head. It's impossible for a political movement to present itself as liberating if there's only one strand, and in this case, that of white, cis, heterosexual women, that determines what can be considered legitimate or not. All opinions and means of action within the feminist movement can and should coexist. If Renia Delage had rejected every feminist idea after discovering that white feminism was not for her, she may never have become interested in black feminism. And if ACT UP had not maximized its effectiveness among its activists, the fight against AIDS might not be where it is today. On a similar basis, spin doctor Yuri Casarino believes that nuance should be at the very heart of the feminist movement. And she explains this by once again quoting Donna Haraway, the American feminist scientist.
She was a research scientist and a biologist and also a feminist. And she worked in laboratories where they produced napalm during the Vietnam War. But at the same time, she was active in the peace movement. And I'm going to quote her. I just find her words so reassuring. I think about this so often. She says, in short, we are all cyborgs. And to me, that means that we are never just one thing or another.
A cyborg is a fictional creature, half robot, half human. Donna Haraway's point is that in order to get rid of the patriarchy, we need to accept that feminism is not a completely homogenous movement, which is in line with the points made by the authors Renia Delage and Sarah Schulman. To be effective, we need to see feminism as a melting pot, a coexistence of many identities. And that's why, according to Yuri Casarino, being a radical feminist doesn't mean erasing everything. It means going back to the roots and deciding what you want to keep and what you want to throw away.
So, I think that right now, it's more about trying to reform institutions. I think it's interesting. I think there are openings. We've been helped by the Me Too movement. We were helped. Now maybe is the right time to try to dismantle toxic structures instead of simply knocking them down and then rebuilding them.
For Yuri Casarino, it's neither possible nor desirable to completely demolish the society in which we live. You have to dismantle it from within, like with Geneviève Fraisse-Cruz in episode 1. But we mustn't reject everything. For her, we must also show nuance in our judgment. On the one hand, we have to constantly doubt the world in order to formulate constructive criticism of it. And on the other, we get shouted down by conservatives for daring to publicly denounce injustices on TV. At the same time, we're reprimanded by the very same conservatives for not being nuanced enough. It's impossible to understand. For Rejane Sénac, feeling more confused and passionate is a red flag. It means that doubt, which until now has been a driving force for change, for joyfully questioning institutions, is becoming toxic. Especially for us. So Rejane Sénac gave me her method for bringing nuance to my negative thoughts, for overcoming the confusion. How do you keep going? How do you make sure it doesn't eat you up?
It's not easy. I keep myself busy. And I also tell myself that the end goal is bigger than myself. It's stronger than I am. I have to hold on. It's what gives meaning to my life. At the same time, I remind myself, I feel alive. I feel like I'm in the right place. Sometimes the right place is letting yourself be criticized. That's what you have to accept. The right place for me sometimes is getting torn to shreds. I get torn to shreds, and I have the nerve to think it's unfair.
Ever since I started writing my newsletter, Les Glorieuses, I had doubts. Are we right to want to shake up the system so much? I constantly ask myself that question. I doubt my abilities to survive the harshness of the feminist commitment. The attacks are relentless, the support is minimal, and those around us confuse Twitter posts with topics of conversation in our daily lives. The victories amplify the hate, the visceral resentment of those who don't see the downside of continuing to live in this system. To achieve a feminist society, we need to question what we know, and to do so without being consumed by doubt or falling into an overly dualistic vision of our institution, well, for that we need nuance. Because the greatest danger for feminism, as for all social movements, is the tendency to fall into an all-or-nothing approach. The for, the against, the yes or the no. I want to believe that we live in an ideal world where the law protects us all equally. But when I learn about the way in which some women who are victims of sexual violence are treated by certain judges or police officers, the doubts creep in again. It persists and pushes me to research, to find out more. And in doing so, nuance is born. As I read around the issue, I realize that the problem is not with some law enforcers, nor with all the law enforcers. The root of the problem lies not with the individual, but with the system that embodies the violent domination of patriarchy in our society. To make a nuanced judgment is to say that these law enforcers are human beings, and that if they were better trained, they would be able to practice their profession in a more egalitarian and therefore more efficient way. So having a nuanced view does not mean rejecting the law as a whole, but transforming it. So I look for nuance. I position my opinions on the spectrum of my subjectivity. And thanks to this nuance, I continue to feed my imagination, my utopia. And my utopia is a nuanced and feminist society, in which a diversity of ideas and respect for each and every person are the basic values. So it's up to us to have the courage to look for nuance, even when our opponents try to prevent us from doing so. The next and final step is utopia, the method that will change your life. I'm Rebecca Amselem, and you've just listened to the fifth episode of The Method, a co-production by Louis Media and Gloria Media. This documentary series was directed by Alexandra Candy-Longuet. I co-wrote it with Lena Coutreau in collaboration with Fanny Ruet. Soukaina Kabal was editing and producing. The original music was composed by Clémentine Charuel and Julie Rouet. Stephanie Williamson translated the text from French to English. Cathy Watts was the English voice of Yuri Casalino. If you're interested in this podcast and you liked it, please talk about it around you. Thank you.